Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best you can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 12 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Here we are. Once again, just like last week, we're near the end of the school year. I think that the students in our area have only 3 or 4 days left of school.
I think that spring fever is in full bloom, and everybody's ready for this year to be over with, especially with the testing fiasco that we just experienced.
Yes. Our column this week in the Ledger at theledger.com, we talked about how the new information here in the state came out that none of the high school math EOCs are going to count. So Algebra 1 EOC, Geometry EOC, and Algebra 2 EOCs are all, in essence, going to be thrown out.
More good news from the testing capital.
After all of that work, after all of the effort, after all of the time spent and wasted on those tests, the scores are not going to be used.
And it's all for naught. So we lost weeks and weeks and weeks of instructional time, and they're not going to count. But before we say, well, that's just this year, no, this is going to be an ongoing problem. Large chunks of instructional time will continue to be given up for this high-stakes testing program that everybody seems to be wedded to. We don't have to be wedded to it, but everybody seems to be. And we need to think long and hard about whether we want to continue such programs in our schools.
Yeah, so that was some big news that came out this week. And, well, I have to mention this, much to Dr. Richard's disappointment, I will mention that my favorite soccer team sealed up its Premier League championship last weekend, Chelsea Football Club.
It's hard to do a sigh on these microphones, but that was a sigh.
Okay. Man, it was a great season for them. So lots of good things this week. Chelsea wins the league, lifts the trophy, and test scores are thrown out.
Right, that's good news.
A lot of good things. So in today's episode, we're going to talk and continue our talk about ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We'll do a quick recap from last week just to make sure that everybody's on board and caught up with what we're talking about. And then we'll kind of go into some newer information or some different information about really why we're seeing an increase in diagnoses, how we diagnose the disorder, because that's a question that a lot of people ask. You know, how do you diagnose ADHD? And that's not a really straightforward, easy answer.
Not an easy answer.
But we'll kind of go through that. And then we'll talk about a little bit about what we'll do about it, what kind of treatments are available and what we do here in our clinic, and what are some of our plans are for the future here at our clinic to really provide a little bit more care for our patients. That sound good to you?
Sounds good. Let's go.
All right. So last week, we talked about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and we talked about how it's been around for a very long time. I think you found an article or a paper written from the 1780s.
Right.
So this is certainly not a new phenomenon. It's not something that's created by the pharmaceutical company. It's not something that is...
Nothing to do with video games or television or diet or anything else. This disorder's been around for hundreds of years. It's been described for hundreds of years.
Absolutely. And so as we talked about last week, the symptoms of ADHD include a family, I guess, of symptoms associated with inattention, then a group of symptoms associated with hyperactivity and impulsivity. Right. And depending on the combination and the number of symptoms that the kid or adult experiences, the diagnosis is a little bit different, whether it's ADHD predominantly inattentive subtype, ADHD predominantly hyperactive impulsive type, or ADHD combined type, where the child has problems with both inattention and hyperactivity and impulsivity. So symptoms have to be present and impairing before the age of 12. They have to be present in more than one setting. And there has to be an impairment for the diagnosis to be made. Mm-hmm. I think that sums up most of the diagnostic stuff.
And the important issue there is there has to be impairment. It's not sufficient that you just have the symptoms. You have to have the symptoms, but there has to be some impairment because of those symptoms.
Beautiful segue. Because what we have to spend some time emphasizing is that there is a difference between demonstrating ADHD symptoms and being diagnosed with ADHD. We kind of touched on that a little bit last week, but I want us to spend a little bit more time on it this week, because as we get into some of the rationale or reasons for why we're seeing so many more diagnoses, I think that that is where the problem lies.
That we're seeing symptoms, but maybe not seeing the disorder.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Right. And what we mean by this is that if you enter into a setting where the subject matter being discussed is too challenging for you, if the expectations of the environment exceed your ability to manage, you know, if any of us are required to sit with no stimulation for hours, at some point we are going to lose focus. We are going to become fidgety. We are going to need to move around a little bit because the expectations of the environment begin to exceed our capacity to manage our behaviors and our attention and our focus. Well, for some kids and for some people, that threshold varies. I've seen people in airports and in doctors' waiting rooms, and they could just sit there for hours. And I sit there sort of almost in awe of these people, thinking, oh my gosh, how can they sit there without moving for so long?
I had a doctoral student when I was at the University of Texas, and she said she couldn't wait for Saturdays to come because she could sit at her dining room table for 8 hours at a time and do nothing but work on her dissertation. And I marveled at her. I can't understand how anybody can sit in one place for 8 hours. And she said that she couldn't wait for Saturdays to come so she could have that time to sit for 8 hours and do nothing but write.
Wow.
I couldn't do it.
No. It's really a challenge sometimes when I'm with my patients. And that's one of the joys that I have of working with kids, because at least we can get up and move around a little bit and we can do something while we're talking. It's really a challenge sometimes just to sit down for 15 minutes.
Right.
I get antsy in the car sometimes.
It's hard to sit still.
So what we're talking about, or what we're getting to, is that when the expectations of the environment exceed your capacity, you begin to exhibit symptoms that could look like ADHD, whether you have ADHD or not. And you know, this is very abstract, because we can't see ADHD. There's not a growth on your body. There's not a physical sign that says, aha, that's ADHD. Instead, what we have to do is look at clinical symptoms, clusters of behaviors that suggest the presence of a disorder. And, you know, where some of the art, I suppose, of mental health comes in is to be able to take those symptom clusters and put them together to make sense of them, to identify what really is a disorder versus what is just symptoms caused by environmental expectations. So the most basic example is reading, right? If I put a book in front of you and it's written in a language that you can read, you can read it. If I put a book in front of you that's written in a language that you don't understand, you're not going to be able to read it. The symptom is that you can't read the book. It does not mean that you have a disorder known as dyslexia. Mm-hmm. It does not mean that you have a reading disorder. So there's a difference between symptom and disorder. And that's where a lot of people get confused when it comes to, and let's be honest, a lot of clinicians get confused as it relates to what we should and should not diagnose in children and adolescents and even adults. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we have symptoms, and I guess what we should talk about next is, well, what's next on our agenda here is, why are we seeing an increase in the diagnosis? And we believe that we're seeing an increase in diagnosis because we're seeing an increase in symptoms.
Okay, so let me summarize and make sure I understand. So you're saying there's a difference. We should be making a distinction between what is a probably inherited neurodevelopmental disorder called ADHD.
Correct.
And we should distinguish that from the symptoms of this disorder that may not be the disorder.
Correct.
You may have the symptoms, but not the disorder.
Right.
And when you talk about environmental expectations, you're saying that environmental expectations could create the symptoms of ADHD. So it may look like a child has ADHD, but in fact, it's just environmental expectations that are creating the symptoms.
Right.
It's not the disorder.
Right.
And so I guess where you're going now is that we have to start to distinguish between kids who have the disorder, how do we know, versus those who are just exhibiting symptoms of ADHD.
Right.
Okay, good.
Right.
All right, on track.
So the first reason I believe that we're having an increase in symptoms,
okay,
which of course is contributing to an increase in diagnoses, probably inappropriately.
Okay, so this gets to that whole question of are there more kids with ADHD today than there were a generation ago?
Correct.
Okay, and so we hear that all the time. There are too many kids getting this diagnosis.
Right.
And what you're saying is, we may have an increase in symptoms, but not an increase in the disorder.
Right.
Okay, good.
Right. Yeah, I don't think that we're actually seeing, and we will get into the same discussion in future podcasts as it relates to autism, as it relates to bipolar disorder.
It could relate to any disorder.
Correct, right.
Like autism, we see this increase in autism. It may just be that we're seeing more symptoms. We're calling it a disorder, and it may not be the real disorder.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, do we really want to believe that 20 years ago, we were missing 1 in 66 kids with autism?
I don't think so.
I don't think anybody was that. Mm-hmm. If there's any argument, clinicians were more clinical back 20 or 30 years ago than they are now. Now we're much more laboratory-based.
Right.
So I think that what we're seeing and have to work to differentiate is this issue between symptoms and diagnosis or the actual disorder.
Okay.
So one of the first reasons, I think, and we touched on this last week, is the issue of schools. And we've sort of spent a lot of time, a lot of podcast time, talking about issues at the school. And so we're only going to spend a couple of minutes on this, but any time you create a situation where you're advancing a curriculum, advancing the expectations, and again, using these words very specifically, we're increasing the expectations of the environment in schools to a level that may not be suitable for kids who are even developmentally appropriate. Mm-hmm. So a kid could be a typical fourth grade student, a typical, 10 or 11 year old child, developing well, can read, can do math. But if you push the curriculum enough, he's going to look disordered. He's not going to be able to concentrate and focus because the teacher's talking about things that he doesn't understand at a pace that he can't keep up with. And it's not his fault.
Mm-hmm.
But he will look like he has ADHD. He will look like he is inattentive, off task. He'll become fidgety. He'll get out of his seat when he's not supposed to because he's got to do something. So as we continue to press our curriculum, we're going to continue, I think, to see an increase in reported symptoms associated with ADHD.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's what we're seeing in kindergarten today.
Right.
As I go around the country doing talks, the children that most schools are concerned about are these kindergarten students who are having temper tantrums and outbursts and becoming very oppositional. What they could be reacting to is a curriculum that's demanding more than they're able to produce.
Right.
Because today's kindergarten student is expected to read, expected to write, expected to do math. It's no longer just socialization. It's not a place to learn to go to school. It is school. Kindergarten is what for us was the first grade.
Right.
And many students, especially boys, are not developmentally ready to do that kind of highly focused work.
Right. Okay. And depending on where the child goes, sometimes pre-K-4 even gets into some of those things where they're expected to read and, mm-hmm. and those things. And
So you're saying is if you push down the curriculum, you're creating environmental stressors that the kids are reacting to in ways that look like ADHD.
Right.
They become inattentive, they become distractible, they become more active because they're no longer interested, they're no longer able to do what's going on, so they're no longer interested in it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And it doesn't have anything to do with any type of learning issue behavioral issue or really even a neurological issue in any way. It just has to do with the environment. And we often refer to that as opposed to a learning disorder, we call that a curriculum disorder.
Right.
The curriculum is not suited for that.
That's, typical age child.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. So that's one thing. The next thing is, and again, we kind of touched on this last week, is the structure of the family.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different now than it used to be.
Right.
And you know, we could spend podcasts talking about whether that's good or bad, how we got to where we are. But nonetheless, we are where we are. We live in a situation now where we have more single parents than ever before. We have the rate of divorce is continuing to, well, it's pretty steady, I guess, at around 50% or so. But what's the problem now is, whereas second marriages used to last longer, now second marriages are starting to last even less time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're getting into blended families. We're having more and more situations where grandparents and non-parental family members are serving as the parents and guardians for children.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this creates more stress.
There's another thing about divorce that's happening, and that is that custody is now 50-50.
Right.
Each parent gets the child half time. And there are children moving back and forth on a fairly rapid basis, either daily
mm-hmm.
or weekly. You know,
right.
Or they're spending half the week at dad's and half the week at mom's. And frequently the parents have different parenting styles and different schedules, and that's very disruptive for some children who need more predictability and more regularity.
Right. I need to note that down because we need to make that into another podcast. But
The 50-50?
The 50-50 issue.
Yeah, the changes. That, because before it used to be that most children stayed with, typically young children, stayed with their mother.
Right.
And they would go to dad's on weekends.
Right.
So that at least the school week had a regularity to it.
Right.
Now the school week is being, there are kids literally living out of backpacks.
Right.
I mean, they have their toothbrush and their clothes and everything in their backpack.
Right. Because
they're going back and forth.
And what is important to note, of course, is that both Richard and I are fathers, and so we are all about, you know, dads having time with their kids and all of that kind of stuff. But the issue is that, you know, our focus is on what is best for the child.
What's best for the kid, right?
And while it's certainly best for the child to have some opportunities with both parents, you know, creating disruption in their schedule to that extent oftentimes leads to mm-hmm. problems.
And once again, some kids can handle it.
Right.
And others
can't.
Are completely undone by these rapid changes in residence.
Right, right. These changes in the family structure are causing more problems. So, you know, mm-hmm. when a child in a situation such as that, you know, they're with dad for the week and dad has his parenting style. And then when he goes back to mom, you know, he's maybe more disorderly than what mom expects because mom has a different style.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he comes back to dad, he's more disorderly because he's adjusting from mom's style back to dad's style.
Right.
And that transition time often leads to problems and, again, leads to not doing their homework. It leads to difficulty sitting and concentrating. It leads to not following directions despite knowing and understanding what the rules are, all of which are symptoms of ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
So the family structure in and of itself is having a consequence on symptoms that we often associate with ADHD. Again, I don't think it's causing ADHD, but it's sort of creating an environment that nurtures the growth and the presentation of symptoms associated with mm-hmm. ADHD. And as you talked about last week, your example was really good last week, Richard, where you were talking about, you know, at noon on Sundays, you knew where you were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the expectation was that you were going to sit there until your grandfather got up.
Right.
And that was it. It didn't matter if you had ADHD. It didn't matter if you were, you know, anything else was going on. That's where you were at that time.
Right. Yeah, I call that opportunities to learn how to inhibit. My urge was to eat quickly and run outside.
Right.
But I had to learn how to inhibit that urge because the expectation was that I had to stay at the table as long as he was at the table. And so that was a good learning opportunity. Same thing with church. We talked
right.
about that. The expectation of before there was children's church, children were expected to sit through an adult service and behave themselves.
Yeah.
And their parents saw to that. So again, these opportunities to learn inhibition are disappearing. And we don't have that same expectation of kids, and we don't provide them with opportunities to learn inhibition. When you can sit at a dinner table with your cell phone,
right,
you don't have to inhibit anything. It's not that the cell phone's creating the problem. It's that we lose an opportunity for children to learn how to inhibit their impulses.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And to be honest, today, because parents are so busy, because mm-hmm. both parents tend mm-hmm. to work, because children are often left at home after school without supervision.
Sure.
And again, that's not a new thing. That was the case for me mm-hmm. as well back mm-hmm. in the 80s. But the difference is that the routine is not there anymore. And when the routine is gone, what we lose is the anticipation, the expectation of what is to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, when we talk about behavioral issues, we talk about things called antecedents, what happens before the behavior. Mm-hmm. And what we really work on with families here is, how can you prepare the antecedent such that you receive the behavior that you're looking for?
Right.
And oftentimes we totally set our kids up for failure. We completely set them up to not be able to meet our expectations because, one, we don't tell them what our expectations are.
Mm-hmm.
And two, we create an environment that says, do what you want, but this is what I want you to do.
Right. Right.
I mean, we're both married. We know what that's like. We know what it's like.
I'm not going to touch that one.
I don't know if my wife listens to the podcast. But when the expectation is there, then it needs to be clearly articulated to
right.
the child.
Right.
And the environment needs to be set up in
that's
such
right.
a way that that expectation can be met.
You have to create circumstances that increase the possibility that the child would do what is expected.
Right.
And those are what Dr. Burney's talking about with antecedent conditions, is you have to set up the conditions for success rather than waiting for the child to make a mistake and then punish the child for making a mistake. You set up circumstances that lead to success.
Right, right. And I'm not going to get off this wife thing.
No, don't go there. Stay away from that.
But the only reason I'm going to mention it again is because it's the butt of so many jokes.
True.
Right?
That's
when, all the jokes that says when Valentine's Day is coming up and your significant other says, oh no, don't get me anything. We know what that really means, right? That's the joke, is that we really know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets you up for failure
right.
when the expectations are not clearly articulated.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's jokes, but when it comes to our kids, mm-hmm. that's what real life is.
Right.
The expectations aren't clearly articulated. We have to do a better job at that. And that's one of the things we work with our parents here, is to help them articulate those expectations in such a way that the child clearly knows what they need to do, and so they have a much higher likelihood of success. Our third possible cause for an increase in ADHD symptoms, not ADHD the disorder, ADHD symptoms, is going to be something a little bit more controversial, and that is nutrition.
Mm.
I wrote about this in our column a couple weeks ago, and I had to write that I was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right, I remember that.
Yeah. And let me just, I wasn't completely wrong. I was only partially wrong.
He takes responsibility and then he gives it back. Okay, let me see where this is going to go now.
All right, so the main culprit, well, there's a couple of main culprits, but one of the main culprits is sugar. Now, Richard, how long have we heard that sugar causes ADHD?
Since before you were born.
Yeah.
But I was working.
Yeah.
No, it's been around for 40 years now, since the 1970s at least.
Right.
Somehow children consuming sugar was related to ADHD symptoms.
Right.
And there have been many, many, many detailed studies, very carefully done studies, to show that there doesn't seem to be a link between the consumption of sugar and the creation of ADHD symptoms. And that's what we were taught, and that's what we were led to believe. So I think when you say you were wrong, you were referring to sugar doesn't cause ADHD.
Right.
Okay. And that's what you were explaining in that article.
Right.
Right. Okay.
It doesn't cause ADHD.
Right. And I think that's the important word, is cause.
Right.
Right.
Now, does it elicit ADHD-like symptoms?
And that's the other issue, because when you say cause, it doesn't cause the disorder, but it creates symptoms that are associated with ADHD. Right. That's what you're talking. That's that important distinction again, is that sugar doesn't create ADHD. Sugar creates symptoms that have been associated, that explain, that define the disorder. It's not the disorder. It's just the symptoms.
Right. Okay. Right. And so let's talk about then for just a few minutes about what sugar does. Sugar's in everything.
Right.
I've been working over the past couple of weeks of cutting sugar out of my diet as best I can. I can eat steak.
Which is a real accomplishment. I have to add this. Because when I met Bernie, he lived on corn dogs and gummy bears and Sour Patch things. What are those?
Sour Patch Kids.
Sour Patch things. Yeah. You know. Yeah. He ate candy like a child.
They're fantastic.
When he was an adult. So this has been a real effort for you.
Don't forget Twizzlers.
And Twizzlers.
Yeah.
I tried to introduce him to chocolate, but he liked all that other candy. But that's what you're talking... So right. This is an effort for you.
Yes, yes.
Because you were very enthused about
right.
candy and
right.
junk food.
And that's... And you've met my mom.
Right.
That is heritable, I think.
She's got the same disorder?
Oh, she eats candy.
Does she really?
She
that's
sweets.
Her candy in her.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she... That's just how we grew up. I mean, you know, a gallon of tea will have, you know, 2.5 cups of sugar in it. I mean, that's sweet
it's
tea.
It's called syrup.
Yeah, it was good stuff. But when you look at foods, even foods that we buy, especially
right.
processed foods,
mm-hmm.
it is all with sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And this problem really came about starting in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because in the 1980s, what really started to boost is low fat.
Low fat diet.
Everybody right. was saying, okay, we need to cut back fat.
Right.
And so we started having all of these products that were low fat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you take the fat out of food,
right.
food tastes lousy. And so there were only two things to make food palatable if you take out all the fat, sugar and salt.
Right.
Now, the salt's not so bad. We'll save that for another time. But the sugar is what's causing a lot of problems. And it's probably one of the main culprits for why we have such an increase in obesity and obviously the increase in diabetes and heart problems and things like that. So let me throw out a few numbers. I'm not a physician. I didn't study this in graduate school, but you know, I've been doing a lot of research over the last couple of months, putting some of this information together. And what I'm finding is fascinating. In a healthy person's body, at sort of homeostasis, we have about 4 grams of sugar. Because our body needs sugar.
4 grams would be what?
About a teaspoon.
Okay.
We need sugar for our cells to work and for our body to function. So, you know, sugar's not all bad, but we need some of it. According to the FDA, the normal daily allowance is about 25 grams. That's a lot.
You're saying that we need 4.
We have 4 in our body.
Okay.
The daily allowance, according to the FDA, is about 25 grams.
You mean it's okay to have 25 grams?
That's what the FDA says.
Okay.
Right. All right. Now, if we use those as rough estimates, if you drink a 12-ounce can of Mountain Dew,
mm-hmm.
that's 46 grams of sugar.
Okay.
That's close to twice the daily allowance by the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay. So what does our body do in response to that? Well, when we consume that much sugar at one time, our body has to respond to it. The sugar, it's very simple sugar. It's not complex sugar that's mixed with fiber that we get in fruits and stuff like that, which are good sources of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably where part of the 25 grams comes from. That's part right. of the FDA recommended, is it from sugars from fruits and vegetables and things like that. But when we consume that much really just raw sugar, our body responds very quickly because since it's been manufactured and broken down so much, it gets into our blood system very, very quickly.
Right.
And so our pancreas has to respond by releasing insulin.
So this large ingestion, and that would be a large ingestion of
a very
sugar.
Large,
by
very
drinking
large.
A mountain, that's a lot. I mean, it's
right.
twice what we should get.
And that's a can. Most people drink bottles now.
Right.
But that's a can.
12-ounce can.
Versus a 16 or 20-ounce bottle, right?
Right. So a person has this influx, this consumption of sugar, and that then has to be broken down by the body.
Right.
And it
right.
gets broken down by insulin?
By insulin, okay?
Okay.
And now let's kind of talk about where we have been before. Both Richard and I are on neuropsychology listservs and things like that. And Richard, I'm sure you've seen it as well, the Mountain Dew breakfast.
Right.
Where there's neuroscientists that encourage parents or tell parents that it's okay
mm-hmm.
to give their ADHD child Mountain Dew for breakfast because sugar is a stimulant. Well, mm-hmm. and caffeine is a stimulant. So, and what do we treat ADHD with? Stimulant medication. So right. the stimulation from the caffeine and from the sugar can and often does help with the attention of the child, at least for a little while, about an hour to two, maybe. It's the aftermath that's really the problem. Okay, so you have this huge influx of sugar,
right.
insulin responds. And what the insulin does in a healthy person, even, is it works very well to get all the sugar out.
Right.
Well, what it does is it gets all of the sugar out.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go from a very quick burst of sugar in your system to hypoglycemia, basically. It takes out all the sugar. And so now you went from a hyperglycemic condition right. to a hypoglycemic
so condition. So now you're low again. So now your insulin low. Has absorbed it all.
Right. And okay. it's converted it all, and usually it converts it to fat, okay. just so you know. It converts some of it to energy, but the rest it sends to fat.
So it'll use what it can.
Right.
And then anything that it doesn't use, it stores as fat.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That's how sugar makes us fat.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Because that's our body's default. Our body's default is right. if we can't use it right now, turn it to fat.
Or if we don't
save it for later.
If our body doesn't know what to do with it,
right.
it stores it somewhere as
right.
fat.
Okay. Right. So when we have the hyperglycemic, when we have the high sugar, a lot of times, for a lot of kids, there's no problems during that time.
Right.
Because, again, if they have ADHD, then they're attentive and they may be working. The problem comes with the sharp decline in glycemic index. And what happens when we become hypoglycemic is we have difficulty concentrating. We have difficulty right. focusing. We become irritable,
mm-hmm.
Agitated. Think about how you feel when you're really hungry. You right. have very short fuse. You become mm-hmm. agitated easily and those kinds of things. Then your body says, hey, we need more sugar because we just got rid of all the sugar, so we need some more sugar. Mm-hmm. And so your body, then your adrenal glands will release adrenaline because it's got to give your body some kind of fuel to then go get more sugar, to get more food. And so okay. it releases adrenaline, which makes us fidgety,
okay.
hyper, makes us more active. And so what happens after you have that sharp drop in sugar index in your system is you have this combination of hypoglycemia and an increase in adrenaline that causes inattention, irritability, fidgetiness, impulsivity, agitation. And those are symptoms oftentimes attributed to ADHD.
So that's what you meant when you said you were right, or you were wrong, but
right.
only partially wrong.
Only partially wrong.
Okay. It's not the sugar. I mean, the sugar begins a cascade of events.
Correct.
Okay. It's not the sugar itself that's doing it.
Right.
I think all of us parents are saying, well, if kids eat cake or they drink soda or eat large amounts of sugar, they become hyperactive.
Right.
And we blame the sugar.
Right.
But it's not the sugar itself. It's the metabolic process that is initiated by sugar that really ends up with adrenaline.
Right.
So it's really, adrenaline's really the culprit.
That's really the culprit,
okay,
right.
Because that's creating, it's adrenaline, it's low blood sugar, hypoglycemia.
Right.
And adrenaline.
Right.
That are creating the problem.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Got it.
So obviously when patients come to us and say, okay, you know, I think my kid has ADHD and I think that sugar is related to it, I'm just going to cut sugar out of his diet.
Right.
I'm going to say, okay,
mm-hmm.
go ahead.
Yeah.
Now, I know that the sugar is not causing ADHD, the disorder.
Right.
It's causing ADHD symptoms. And so what I know is that that patient is going to do better
right.
because if the sugar is mm-hmm. through this cascade of events is causing ADHD symptoms,
right.
their symptoms are going to get better.
Right, right.
Now, the concern, of course, comes when the parent then says, well, you know, I cut mm-hmm. the sugar out of their diet and it cured his ADHD.
Okay.
Those are always concerning kinds of statements for me. Mm-hmm. And I will let the parent have it usually. I won't say too much, but
you mean you'll let the parent continue thinking that?
Correct.
You won't let them have it like,
oh yeah,
I'm going to launch a full frontal assault.
Okay. No, I will let them have that perspective. Because it doesn't matter. But it is a little bit of false belief
right.
because...
But beneficial.
Beneficial.
Right.
Right.
They're right for the wrong reason.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So sugar is definitely something that we have to target when we're talking about treatment and when we're talking about the assessment of ADHD, which we're going to get to in just a moment.
And the other thing that we need to remember, you kind of brought this up earlier, is that we think in terms of large ingestions of sugar, birthday parties, other events where kids are eating high sugar foods. But in fact, much of our diet consists of foods that are high in sugar. It's hidden in fructose and other kinds of sugars, but it's still there.
Right. I mean, the worst, of course, is high fructose corn syrup,
which is in many of the foods that we eat.
Right.
But so kids who eat a lot of processed foods could be consuming very large amounts of sugar, and they could be creating this metabolic process throughout the day.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I mean, I was looking at a can of peas yesterday at the grocery store, and I was looking at the ingredients. Sugar is listed as one of the ingredients in just a can of beans. So you really have to be careful, because we don't really think about how often we are consuming it. And very interestingly, I was listening to another podcast the other day, and they were talking about, you know, fruits are good because fruits combine sugar with fiber that makes it to where it lasts longer in your system. It's not such a shock to your system, and your body processes it differently. But they were differentiating that from fruit juices.
Right.
And if you look at most fruit juices, they have a lot of sugar. Even if it's 100% fruit juice, oftentimes it's really high in sugar. And we think, oh, that's okay because there's no added sugar.
Right.
It often says no added sugar. There's still a lot of sugar in it from the fruit. But what they've done in the process of turning it into a juice through their processing system is they've taken out all of the fiber.
They take out the fiber.
And then it becomes bad again.
Okay.
Because now the fiber's not there, the dietary fiber's not there to
slow
cling
down.
To. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And to help.
So
with
this
the process.
Enters your body, juices enter the body much faster.
Right.
Creating this cascade again.
That same cascade.
Okay.
So, you know, the way that we're engineering our food now is really concerning.
Is contributing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. It's really concerning. And you know, what we'll talk more another time about some other things. So I really want to get into the diagnostic stuff, and we're already at 40 minutes. So I want to get more into some of the how do we diagnose ADHD. But, you know, I think it's important to not just think about sugar, but to think about, you know, there's lots of evidence of supporting food sensitivities and how food sensitivities create the fogginess that we often associate with inattention and ADHD. So there's lots of other things to be thinking about with that. And we're just going to have to talk about that on another pod or something, because we don't have the time now. Does that sound okay to you?
Sounds good. So we have three contributing factors that create these symptoms. One is unrealistic expectations or inappropriate expectations the kids can't handle, so they get the symptoms. The second is foods, particularly sugar.
Right.
And the third is
the family structure.
We don't have opportunities.
Right.
For kids to learn how to inhibit and learn how to pay attention and learn how to focus for extended periods of time.
Right.
Okay. So three things: sugar, opportunity, and expectations. Okay.
Yes.
Good.
So let's talk for a few minutes now, for the last little bit that we have on the pod today, about how do we diagnose ADHD. Right. You know, one of the big criticisms with mental health in general is the fact that there are no laboratory tests for ADHD or for any of the disorders that we think about with mental health.
Right.
There's no blood test. You know, I think we often have misnomers that we use, and even when we talk about chemical imbalances with bipolar disorder, well, yeah, it's a chemical imbalance, but it's not like you can assess the chemicals and find out where the imbalance is so that you can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to recognize that these are clinical diagnoses. And because they're clinical diagnoses, what they rely upon is the expertise of the clinician. The clinician has to understand the disorder well enough to differentiate between a cluster of symptoms and a presentation consistent with the disorder. And, you know, I know, Richard, you were too. You know, I had the wonderful opportunity of training with an old school psychiatrist. And when I say old school, he was older than you.
Careful.
He began practicing in the 1940s, and he was first an internist internal medicine, and then he later switched to psychiatry after World War II. And he was fascinating. But he was an old school person who could look at a patient, and you know, he really taught me how to think about a patient as a patient, not as, you know, questionnaires or as data, you know, to really look at and put the symptoms and behaviors together to really make a good diagnosis. Because his perspective was, if you had the diagnosis right, your treatment's going to work.
Right.
And so I work really hard with that. And I know you do too.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have a similar experience. So when we think about this diagnosis, it usually begins with a referral from either the parent or the teacher, right?
Right.
Probably about 50-50, wouldn't you say?
Depending on the age and the parents.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly, we have parents who bring the kid in, their kid in because, well, the teacher told me that I needed to have him evaluated.
Right.
And then we have other parents who bring them in and say, you know, the school doesn't know anything's wrong. I just am worried about his behavior. Right. So,
and sometimes kids come in before school age.
Right.
You know, that they get to the terrible twos,
mm-hmm.
which go into the terrible threes, which go into the terrible fours. And the parent is saying, this child's not settling down like my other kids did. Or this child is still very active compared to his four-year-old playmates. You know, there's something different about this child. So sometimes parents bring children in before school age. Other times it's after school age that somebody says, this child can't handle school because she's too active or too inattentive or too impulsive.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, there's three tools that we use to make a diagnosis of ADHD. The first is questionnaires. Well, we'll go through the three first. Questionnaires, direct observation, and testing assessment. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to questionnaires have a very important utility when it comes to this, because this gives us the opportunity to assess information from both the parent and the teacher, and sometimes the child, depending on the age.
Mm-hmm.
And we can then use their scores, their ratings on these questionnaires to compare them to national samples of children with ADHD or national normative samples to see where the child falls in comparison to their peer group. And it's great information. The problem with questionnaires and why I'm sometimes skeptical of questionnaires is that, for the most part, they're very face valid. And what I mean by that is when it comes to statistical analyses, face validity means that, you know, it's assessing what it looks like it's assessing.
What it's supposed to assess.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So if the question says, true or false, I feel depressed,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty clear, pretty face valid,
right.
what that question is asking.
Right.
If it asks a question like, sometimes I have a hard time getting to sleep, that's not such a clear, the face validity on that is a little bit lower because it's not quite as clear that it's assessing depression symptom.
Right.
So the questionnaires are oftentimes very face valid, especially ADHD rating scales. And so what that means is that parents and teachers can then score it in the direction that is consistent with their beliefs about the child.
Right.
So if they feel like little Johnny is, and it's always funny when I say that because I have a cousin named Johnny, and we used to call him Little Johnny because his dad was named Johnny too. And so when I say Little Johnny, I always think of cousin Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
So the teacher thinks about little Johnny in the classroom and thinks, you know, man, he's so inattentive. And so she starts filling out the questionnaire, and she's going to say often or always for all of them because her perception is already that he's not paying attention. So when she sees has difficulty attending the task, she's going to say, absolutely, say often or always. The other thing is that oftentimes questionnaires are completed, and the magnitude of scores on that scale often reflect the mood of the rater at the time. When I'm teaching this to my graduate students, I often use the example of the teacher, and I say, you know, the parent or the child brings in the questionnaire and gives it to the teacher and says, my mom asked me to give this to you to fill out. And the teacher says, oh, thank you, little Johnny. I'm going to put it on my desk. I'm going to fill it out tomorrow morning. And so the teacher has their day at school that day. The teacher goes home. We'll say it's a male teacher. He goes home and he has a great evening. He gets home and he and his wife go out to dinner. They go see a movie. They have a great evening. He comes in the next morning refreshed because he got to bed early. And he gets up on time and he has his coffee and he sits down and he sees the questionnaire and he picks it up and he says, all right, let's score a little Johnny here. And he's going to fill it out in one way there. Now you take that same exact scenario and that teacher goes home that night and it was Valentine's Day and his significant other told him not to worry about getting him anything. And so he took that at face value. And so he didn't get her anything.
Antecedent conditions.
And he gets in trouble. Failure. Oh, and it's a horrible night. Right. They argue all night long.
He sleeps on the sofa.
Didn't get to sleep till late.
Right.
Wakes up last minute, throws his clothes on, gets there. Traffic all the way to work. He sits down and he says, I got to fill out this questionnaire about Johnny. He's going to fill it out in a very different way that second time. Mm-hmm. Has nothing to do with Johnny.
Right.
But it has to do with his mood at the time. Now, I don't fault the teacher for that. I'm sure that I do the same thing. But we have to recognize some of those limitations of the questionnaires.
Right.
I like them. I use them. Right. But we have to recognize some of those limitations. Observation. You know, the unfortunate truth is that we don't have as many opportunities to go to the schools and observe kids as we would like.
Schools or homes.
Yeah. Schools or homes, right.
I'd love to go into homes and observe some of these kids, but it's difficult to do.
It's mm-hmm. very difficult. But making direct observation, because we have training in such things, mm-hmm. Allows us to be able to look at the student or the child compared to other kids, his or her age, in the same classroom, and it gives us an objective right. look. Because we're not enmeshed like the teacher is or like the other students are or even like the parents are. And we can look at it from sort of as a remote person and do some evaluation and assessments of the behavior. And then the last way that we collect information for a diagnosis is through testing. Mm-hmm. Different clinicians are going to do different things when it comes to testing. Some are going to do questionnaires and an interview, diagnostic interview. And that's about it. We tend to do more here at our office, and I believe that doing more is important because for all the issues that I mentioned regarding questionnaires a moment ago, we can't rely solely on questionnaires. And for some of the same reasons, you can't rely solely on an interview because, you know, depending on how you ask the questions and how the parent or teacher feels at that time, the interview may guide you in the right or wrong direction. So we give testing. We do testing here. It's usually several hours worth of testing. We'll look at intellectual capacity. We will look at academic achievement because, again, most of these students are in our school age. And so we look to see and just to make sure that there's not any learning difficulties that could be contributing to right. their inattention. That's always an important thing to rule out. And then most importantly, we look at executive functioning skills. ADHD is a disorder of executive function, as we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. And so there are very specific tests that we can administer that look at the child's attentional capacity, their planning and organization, their inhibition. And we can look very specifically at that through mm-hmm. direct testing. And it's the direct testing that really lets us know what the child can and can't do.
Right. But it's not an ADHD test.
Right.
I mean, there is no test like you said in the beginning, in the introduction, there is no test for ADHD.
Right.
But there are tests we can administer to determine whether or not the child seems to have the disorder or not.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And so we give this battery, and the battery varies depending on the presentation of the child. And so sometimes it will include two or three tests. Sometimes it will include three or four or five tests, mm-hmm. Depending on the child's presentation and their age and those things. But we take that data, we combine it with the questionnaires, we combine it with the interviews and observations of the child, at least in our office. Sometimes when a kid really has ADHD, you can tell in the office.
Right.
And we combine all of that information for our diagnostic profile. You know, we have to be cautious that we're not missing another disorder. I always like to say that children experience all the same feelings and emotions and perspectives that we do as adults. They just don't have the behavioral repertoire to exhibit it and differentiate all of them as well as we do. So a lot of times anxiety will look like ADHD because the anxiety will create fidgetiness, it'll create inattention, sometimes it'll even create hyperactivity. Depression, one of the potential behaviors in children and adolescents with depression is irritability right. and difficulty concentrating. Mm-hmm. So we really have to work hard to differentiate those disorders from ADHD to make sure that we're really looking at what we think we're looking at.
Right.
So the diagnosis isn't easy. A lot of times, you know, I'm always, well, I won't say always, because there are kids that are very clear from the moment they walk in the door. You can tell, okay, if we just rule out a couple of things, there's really no doubt that this kid has ADHD.
Right.
But others, you know, I'm always, with the others, I'm always concerned when I hear about diagnoses that are made in 15-minute sessions mm-hmm. or in, you know, through just questionnaires or through just a few-minute evaluation by somebody and then medication or whatever else is thrown on them, because as we will clearly have to talk about in the next podcast, medication works for most people.
Right.
The medication that we use is going to work for most people, whether they have ADHD or not.
Right.
It's going to make you more attentive.
Right.
And so medication by in and of itself is not confirmatory diagnostically.
Right.
So we have to deal with that issue.
So when we talk about ADHD, we're talking about a clinical diagnosis. And what a clinical diagnosis means is somebody, some person or some group of people have to combine all the information they have on this child and make a determination of whether or not the child has the symptoms. And that's number one.
Right.
Does the child have a sufficient number of symptoms to get the diagnosis? And then second, does the child have the disorder? Because as we've said throughout the podcast, child can have symptoms but not the disorder.
Right.
Or have symptoms and have the disorder.
Right.
But that's a clinical judgment that somebody has to make based on the information they gather from parents, teachers, and from their own observations of the child.
Right.
Okay. Good information. I like the distinction between having the symptoms and having the disorder. I think that's an important differentiation.
Yeah, and I think that is at least in part mm-hmm. the explanation for why we continue to see an increase in prevalence.
So we're not seeing more disorder, we're seeing more symptoms.
We're seeing more symptoms that are being classified as a disorder.
Right, right. But it's really not. So we don't have an increase in ADHD. We have an increase in kids who display symptoms of ADHD.
I think so.
So as Dr. Silver said, if we may continue to stand on his shoulders, Dr. Silver said, if you make an accurate diagnosis, you're going to get to an accurate intervention.
Right.
And that's the goal here, is that what we need is an intervention.
Right.
Begins with an accurate diagnosis.
Right.
Okay.
Right. It all starts there.
Good. Good.
And so we're going to have to hit that on our next pod.
Look forward to that.
So I hope that this podcast was informative for you. I always enjoy talking about ADHD.
I do too.
So definitely, you know, write to us if you have similar or different opinions or views on ADHD. Write to us either on Facebook or on our blog at thementalbreakdown.com. You know, I would love for you to write any kind of comments or reviews on iTunes. We really appreciate that. It just kind of increases the visibility of the podcast so other people will be able to hear it. And certainly follow us on Twitter at Dr. Bernie is my handle. And on Facebook, we post a lot of articles and things throughout the week just to get more information out there. Anything that we see that seems interesting, we try to share it with everybody. Anything else?
Nope, that's good. That was a good morning.
Morning. Good morning. Mm-hmm. All right. So then until next time, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And we look forward to talking with you next week.
Yep, let us know.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.